About 1,500 soldiers from Wisconsin have disappeared in action since World War II, and there are all kinds of reasons for trying to find them. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. Who decides which MIAs to look for? Where does the search begin and who pays for it? We're going to find out from my two guests today. They are Charles Kancitsky, who is the team lead of the UW-Madison Missing in Action Recovery and Identification Project. Also with me is the MIA team historian, Samantha Zinnen. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You know, the scope of this problem, if you want to call it that, is startling, really. When you look at the big numbers, 82,000 Americans are officially listed as missing in action, and 72,000 alone from World War II. Those are huge numbers. And then 7,600 from Korea, and also some 1,600 or so from Vietnam, 1,500 from Wisconsin alone. Where do you begin?
That's the difficult question. Right now, we're well established in Europe, so that's our primary focus right now. However, we do have interest in other locations. One that we've historically, Sam has really spent a lot of time on, is Papua New Guinea, some of the islands north of Papua New Guinea. That is the difficult question.
So we're talking mostly then World War II here, not even Vietnam so much.
Correct.
And why World War II in particular?
Well, the reason why World War II is, if you look at the Department of Defense's agency, the Defense POW MIA accounting agency, their primary focus is on Vietnam and Korea. So we're kind of helping out in the areas that aren't heavily being tackled at this moment, which is Europe.
And the Department of Defense is still interested in these thousands. How many was it? 72,000 MIAs from World War II?
Yep, 72,000 from World War II. And of that, roughly 1,300 plus are Wisconsinites and spread out through that region. So there's a lot of interest for us to be there.
Now, if they're lost at sea, I gather you're probably not going to pursue that unless, like, it's an entire vessel that went down, which would be a different kind of archaeology altogether.
Correct. Yeah, underwater losses falls underneath our category of low probability. And when we're looking at cases, we're looking at the probability in roughly about, 40-45% of the cases are water loss or not probable.
The exception being if those bodies washed ashore at some point, whether from a ship going down or a plane crash. If they did, they likely were buried as unknowns. And we can compile data and go back through records to hopefully figure out probabilities on who this could be, timelines, records, where that they were buried during the war.
Wow, there's so many variables. I mean, if a body washes onto, you know, the beach at Normandy, how would you begin to figure out where it went from there?
There are lots of records, and there's various sources we consult. So there's something called X-Files, and X-Files are for unknown bodies. They were associated with a cemetery. We had temporary cemeteries throughout all of Europe that were later consolidated into the American cemeteries overseas that are managed through the American Battle Monuments Commission. But other countries had their own temporary cemeteries as well, and they've been matched, and every body that was found that was unidentified had an X-file. And so you try to match characteristics in personnel files where there is a name but no body for a missing person with X-files that have bodies.
So they actually, when these individuals were buried hastily in many cases, there were nonetheless some kind of records kept as to physical characteristics?
Physical characteristics, whatever could be known, location, dates, who it was found by, where, if they knew anything about the body, if they had personal effects that survived. And this happened not just for sea losses, but any kind of body that they'd find throughout the war.
So how does it work in terms of, you have to obviously narrow things down a little bit from there. Well, we're talking World War II, we're talking in Europe, and even though I guess, as you indicated, Chuck, there's a great concentration of them in the Pacific, in New Guinea and parts of the Pacific, you're concentrating on Europe. There's more solid ground there, I guess you could say. But then how does the whole thing start in terms of you just wait for the phone call from the Defense Department and say, okay, we've got a case for you?
Well, that's one process, definitely.
Really?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So we are still continually working with the Department of Defense. They've funded our last three summer missions. However, with the UWMIA project, we are now primarily focusing on Wisconsin cases. So we're not waiting for a phone call. We're actually investigating the documentation that we have regarding Wisconsin cases in regions of that we have strong relationships with the foreign authorities. And we're seeking out information, and it could be a rabbit hole, as in we know that this small town has a celebration every year regarding this plane that had crashed in their area because they were fighting to liberate those individuals. So then we may reach out to that mayor asking, do you know where this plane is? Do you know anything regarding the case? I mean, Sam could talk at length regarding one of the cases we're working on right now where we are seeking this information. And the mayor will state, yes, there, we know exactly where the plane crash is. It's in this farm field. It's near here. And
would these, in most cases, have been excavated? I mean, the pilot would have – the body would have been extracted and no? Sometimes yes, sometimes no?
So sometimes yes, sometimes no. It depends on what happened. And who had control of the area at the time of the crash is a major effect in who might have researched it. If the Germans had control over the land, there'd be different processes and there's different bodies of documents to see what they did to check out the plane. There's files. Sometimes we've seen even crash photos of the plane in the situation as it crashed in some German files, depending on what the case is. Or if it's an area that was controlled by the Americans, they might have repatriated those remains to a temporary gravesite. The Germans might have taken it to one of theirs, and then you track those documents. But there's many gravesites or crash sites of planes that no one excavated, that they took notice that it happened. The locals knew. But in terms of the larger battle, there were too many things going on. Mm-hmm. War happens very quickly. And World War II obviously happened on a mass scale.
It does raise an interesting question, though. Allied plane crashes in German territory. How likely are the Germans even to bother to, you know, take the body and process it in any way? Or are they just going to tend to let it go? And it could work the other way, too, of course.
Well, actually, they'd come investigate, make sure that if somebody survived, they would take them prisoner.
Sure.
Also, if there are any weapons available, they would extract whatever they could. Regarding one of our cases where a P-47 crashed, the Germans stated they took three of the machine guns, the M2 machine guns, and we witnessed that because what we found were the remaining machine guns. So their report matched our report.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. So what kind of things are you likely to actually uncover? I mean, if it's a plane crash in particular, what do you find typically, or what would you
expect? Well, we always hope to find the machine guns, because the machine guns, yep, they have serial numbers on them, and that serial number can identify that that gun is related to the plane that we're seeking. So typically we will find the guns because they're mass steel, and they're damaged, but they're not burned to unrecognition. Where we can then review the serial numbers, compare it to the serial numbers on the plane, and confirm that that plane is ours. So it's a very joyous day when we find the machine guns, and that is the reason why. Other things that we may find are personal items. We found money.
After 75 years.
75 years. We found a silk map, which was still in extremely good condition. We found just a number of interesting personal items.
And what do you do with all these? I mean, machine guns included, a kind of a burned up, bent up machine gun, you know, in a way is something special. But on the other hand, what do you do with it?
Well, we've been trying to get one, to have one returned to UW-Madison to put on display. However, they are still classified as weapons of war. So the federal authorities take them and they typically probably destroy them in some manner. But yeah, we find a lot of ammunition, 50 cal, or the 50 cal rifles, a lot of ACW, which is aircraft wreckage, which is part of the plane. But that has no importance to us because it's just material that has no relation So that, in theory, is then turned over to the farmer, the ACW, because it's the farmer's rights to his land and it's his ownership. If there's material that relates to the case, that is then turned over to the federal authorities, as in possible osseous remains, machine guns, any life support, and other personal items. And then that is then turned over to the Department of Defense.
And you have then – you do have these cooperative arrangements with various governments. It sounds like we're talking about mostly, what, France and Belgium?
Yep, France and Belgium.
And you have ongoing cases where they say, oh, yeah, there might be another one over here, and you can check that out sometime?
Yeah, we have dozens of open cases. We work on campus out of the Biotechnology Center, and we have some incredible student volunteers that work with us that spend hundreds of hours each semester for no crash credit. They volunteer their time, and they come in and they work a case. They work several cases at a time. And there are ways for us, because we're very protective of our MIA families. We never want to raise false hope or any expectations ever. That's the worst thing we could do. So when you're researching in a small town or in Europe, there's important documents that you can get from bomb group associations or other veterans organizations or from the town itself. But often when our students research, they claim that it's for a class or a bigger project and that they're not researching one individual or one plane crash. And they're really incredibly talented, our students. They work very hard, kind of turning back the clock, acting as historical detectives.
And your role as a historian, Samantha, in all of this?
So I work with all our students, and I help manage our caseload.
That simple, huh? What kind of background does one have that would be compatible with this kind of work as a historian?
So I graduated from UW-Madison last spring, with a degree, an undergraduate degree in history. And I focused on U.S. military history and policy. And before I transferred to the University of Wisconsin, I was a Normandy scholar at GW.
A Normandy scholar.
Where we'd help recreate the lives of soldiers lost in the Normandy invasion and present our research. So when families go to the cemeteries of in Normandy or anywhere else, they can ask for a name and have a whole life story so they can learn more about what the price of freedom actually is.
Well, that's certainly a phenomenal approach to what we might call living history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not dissimilar kind of what from we do now, but now my work when I recreate a life is to hopefully bring someone home. But it always is to honor a life and to tell their story because they have so much to teach people from that came from their town, students, people growing up, my generation that's further disconnected from any of those major wars we study.
Does make it tangible, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is there ever any danger in these excavations?
Well, there's danger anywhere. So
walking across the street to get here, I know, yeah.
So always assessing risk. There could be dangers for traveling, environments that we may be entering, as well as not just the environment, i.e. country that we're residing in at that time, but also just the level of terrain as well. If you look at our 2018 case, it was the middle of a national forest in France, and there was no path to the site, so one had to be developed, and it was about, 150 yards in from the closest road. So trailing that back and forth, you do have ankle injuries, you have other type of those injuries.
Any issues or concerns about unexploded ordnance?
Yes, so UXO, that's the acronym for that. Yes, we do have protocols for UXO. That could be from the size of ammunition to possible bombs.
Yeah, I mean, because we do today still read about unexploded bombs from World War II.
World War II and World War I, so you have to always think of that as well. So it's not just one, you have one event, it's both events. So.
Stumble across a World War I guy when you're looking for a World War II guy.
Which it happens.
Yeah. Has it really?
Yeah, we found World War I ammunition and barbed wire at our site. So what we typically do is we go through the site with metal detection, and if it matters on what type of metal detection hit that we get, we may investigate further. And then if need be, we also have ground penetrating radar as well as other tools to use.
How do you protect these sites once you've found them and excavated them? I assume it's not a year-round process. How do you protect them from unauthorized entry?
That's one of our worst – I mean, it happens.
And for archaeology in general, I think you can call this archaeology. You know, you go back 2,000 years and there's grave robbers and pyramid robbers.
Happens
and that
to this day.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yep. And so what we do is we typically work with the local federal police or the gendarme, and we're informing them of where we're at, what we're doing, and where we are. And when we close a site, we actually cap the site completely. We rebury everything so that it's absolutely protected.
Everything that you've found? You're not taking anything out at this
point? No, we take everything that we found, we return to the authorities, and then that is turned over to the Department of Defense. But for where we are, so to give you an example, last year we worked a site where we moved 304 cubic meters of soil and sifted through it in a matter of 21 days.
That's a lot of dirt.
It is a lot of dirt. A lot of dirt. We have roughly finished about half of this site. So to protect the site, what we do is we actually tarp the bottom of our hole, and then we have the excavator backfill all the soil on top of it. So then when we come back this coming year...
You know where you left off.
Exactly. We have the excavator dig it right down to the tarp, and we start right where we ended.
How long do these excavations go on, then, if you're talking about from year to year?
Some can take 1 year. Some can take 2 years. It matters on what type of site we're working on.
And... do you have native assistance in these matters? People who are, you know, locals who have some kind of vested interest in these excavations?
Well, actually, just eyewitnesses in general.
Really, from World War II?
Yes.
Probably children then who saw these things go down.
8 years old, 13 years old, yep. And they come to the site, and I can talk about a case at length regarding one eyewitness, and that was our first recovery. But we can get into that maybe a little bit later. Also, we have students in the region. So we had a student from Belgium, a college student who were there in summertime. So then on summer break, she was going to school for archaeology. So we brought her to the site a couple days to help out to get some experience. So we try to have an open door process for the foreigners because we want to be inviting. So then they invite us back.
But before we get into some of the forensics of it and then some of also these individual cases that you've mentioned, Chuck, suppose I have a relative who was, you know, an MIA in World War II. I'd like to find this individual, the remains. What would be the channel for even getting close to that? Again, out of the tens of thousands from World War II, you can excavate one or two in the course of a couple of years, something like that. So how would I even hope to have my relative found?
So especially for Wisconsinites, we'd have them contact us and reach out to us on our website. And they fill out a form and get in contact with us, give us something like their name, where they're from, if they know any details, if they have any documents that they'd be willing to share. And then as soon as we get that, or if we get a call, we have families reach out to us all the time. I open a case file, and we start researching that case as thoroughly as possible. And obviously, we can't promise that we'd be able to bring home the relative. Mm-hmm. No one can. But we can at least provide them answers that they never had, particularly our World War II families. The last thing that they heard was the telegram during the war that was from the War Department that said, "Dear sir, madam, we regret to inform you that your son or your husband went missing in the Pacific Theater or the European Theater of Operation." And that doesn't provide a lot of closure.
And I would guess a lot of that vagueness would be for classified purposes.
At the time, for classified purposes. Now it's something that just helps them. Now giving that information and giving them the answers that they never had before can help them learn what happened, provide closure, and then give answers back to communities. Because a lot of these cases, particularly with National Guard units, it was a whole community that suffered. A lot of our National Guard units early in World War II that came from one hometown.
Yeah, you read about that from time to time, don't you? A particular community in Wisconsin where some incredibly high number of men were lost in the war.
That's part of what I studied for my thesis here at UW, was how small towns and communities were affected by KIA losses and missing in action losses. And the trauma there, psychologists call it ambiguous loss, where because they don't have answers and because it's together that they've mourned and lost and sacrificed, it lingers. It still exists. You can see it through today. And being able to provide those answers and opportunity for closure and learning, it kind of brings the experience back together.
Let's look at some of those forensics then and some individual case studies, too, of MIAs recovered, those in particular from Wisconsin. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guests. They are Chuck Hunsinski and also Samantha Zinnen, and both of them are involved with the UW Missing in Action team, the Identification Recovery and Identification Project. And it's focused primarily on World War II soldiers lost in Europe. They also plan to get increasingly involved with finding MIAs who are from Wisconsin. But this involves, once you come to the site and find, let's say, a crash site in particular, where there's going to be an MIA, once you find those human remains, so you're talking probably just bone fragments, and where do the forensics kick in?
So the forensic kicks in right away because, one, you want to analyze to make sure that what you have is truly what you have. And we have people on the team that will review it. And if it, what we classify it as possible osseous remains, possible human remains, we then, what we call bag it and tag it. And we keep that in a, well, the materials that we do bag and tag, we keep that with us in a secured briefcase that stays with the primary scientific recovery expert, who is Dr. Greg Jameson from UW-Milwaukee. He carries that with him and is with him at all times.
In some of these cases, I would assume you'd have more than one MIA. I mean, in a plane crash, certainly be true of, you know, of a ship fatalities too. So it takes a little bit of sorting out right there, wouldn't it?
Definitely. Yep. There's quite a few bags. It's not just all in one bag. Every single piece has its own bag, documented, photographed. We keep a very detailed database on everything that we've collected, and we're sending that information to the Department of Defense on a weekly basis.
On a weekly basis, how long would it typically take to find out if you have this part of a vertebra who it belonged to?
Well, so with the Department of Defense, they have a lengthy process. It can take roughly 6 to 15 months. One of the reasons why University of Wisconsin has gotten involved is we're trying to show how academia and the tools that academia has can hasten that process. At the University of Wisconsin Biotechnology Center, we can predominantly perform that biological analysis within a month.
So speeding things up considerably, and where do you go from there then?
So what we typically do is if we know the case that we're recovering, we will be working with – we will obtain samples from the family members as well to do a cross-comparison.
DNA we're talking about?
DNA, mm-hmm. Yep. They'll usually give us a mouth swab. We'll perform the analysis there, and then we'll compare it to the analysis that we received from the bone fragments as well.
And – who all would be on one of these actual excavations? So you're not going to have you're not going to have your forensic expert on site necessarily. But what would be? Really, would you?
Actually,
right
we would.
There. And, so and what would he or she be doing? I mean, you can't exactly examine DNA on site, can you?
Well, we call shotgun analysis. So we have been devising this two-stage clean environment that is kind of it's still in development and it's intellectual property. But in theory, what it will allow you to do is perform the DNA analysis in the field. And we're working directly with sequencing companies to see what type of tools they have, which we know some of them. And we're working with them to be able to actually perform the analysis real time in the field at that moment.
Are you on these excavations also?
I have attended our past two, and as I'm just a laborer in the field or act as a historian, can help identify this is where this came from on a plane. This could help tell us this, provide extra research if we find something that could be important on the case or give us a lead and help interview eyewitnesses.
On some of the more remote excavations in terms of historically remote, you don't just go in with a pick and shovel because you don't know what you're going to be destroying on site there. Is this a more of a luxury for you that you can work a little bit on larger bits of ground? I know that you did talk about sifting through,
yep. What,
360 cubic meters, was it,
yes.
Of dirt? How do you actually open the excavation and avoid destroying things that are important?
Correct. So what we do is we take a planned approach. We seek out typically the epicenter of the crash site. You don't always know where that is, so you may need to use ground penetrating radar or other tools in the field to give us a good visual of where the disturbances are.
Because the plane could have broken up when it crashed.
Correct. And with that will then give us a base, and we kind of work our way to it so we're not destroying the epicenter of it. We're working our way to it so we have a good, clean environment to work in while continually moving towards that that possible crash site.
Let's get into some of the case studies then. I mean, individuals missing and found, and maybe even some still missing, I guess. And it's all about the story, as you indicated, Samantha, earlier, that you can then talk to some of these descendants, some of these families of these MIAs, former MIAs in your case, and piece together what they were doing, where they were, and what happened to them. So did this all begin with a story, this project in the first place? This was 4 or 5 years ago now.
Correct. Yep. In 2013, I had a civilian researcher come to the Biotechnology Center, and he had asked, so one of the other services we provide is DNA analysis. And he came in and asked if we could perform DNA analysis on a MIA soldier. And I was very intrigued. I come from a very large military family. And I had asked him for more information because we get a number of unique requests, but this was probably one of the ones that was very unique. And when he informed us of the story, and the individual that we had provided biological analysis for was PFC Lawrence Gordon. He was a Canadian who was working in Montana when World War II broke out, on a farm in Montana. He immediately joined the U.S. Army, was in northern France, was on a mission in a Greyhound scout, and was hit, ammo racked by a German tank, was killed on site. They buried him, the Graves Unit buried him at that time in a U.S. cemetery. And then when the Graves folks came back to relocate them to the primary, he must have been wearing a German T-shirt or something that was German-related. He was killed in August, very hot, wool suits, military, extremely hot, especially being in an armored unit. So he may have saw a German T-shirt that was clean. You never know. But that small or that decision he made at that time kind of made the decision at when the Graves Unit came back to relocate him, and then they reclassified him as an ex-unknown for the Germans. So he became he was unknown as an American, was then changed to unknown as a German, buried in a German cemetery in France.
This would have been still right after the war?
Right after the war, yep. So all countries participated with this civilian researcher. He was a Canadian, U.S. soldier, classified as an ex-German, and buried in France. All countries participated except the U.S. And that's the reason why he came to us seeking the biological analysis, is because the Department of Defense at that time did not feel that it was a high enough probability to do the DNA analysis.
So what made anyone suspect that this was not a German but rather an American?
Well, if you look at the case, I mean, just the case in itself, it's a very lengthy case because of all of the actions that occurred. I can't give you that answer. I don't know, but I could just guess that, you know, a civilian researcher who in their eyes may think that he doesn't have the capabilities or the training to understand this is just, you know.
A lot of things to keep track of,
yes.
A lot of graves to open, and sometimes, I suppose, a hasty decision for one reason or another.
Yep. So we helped this civilian researcher for about a year and a half, moving the process through, working with him as well as the foreign entities. We worked with the INPS, which is similar to the FBI here in the States. The INPS is for the French FBI. And we sent the DNA core director of our center, Dr. Joshua Hyman, with the civilian to the cemetery, and they actually, the French authorities and German authorities, extracted the remains, and they matched the ontology and the teeth.
The dentition.
And, yep. Uh-huh. And it was a high probability. So then the French authorities, as well as us, received bone remains to do the analysis work. And we had collected the family members' DNA in advance, and the comparison came back. 100%.
That would be one of the, I think, kind of more memorable cases that you started with.
Definitely.
Because repatriation from France is one thing for an American, but repatriation from a German cemetery and being mistaken for eternity as being on the other side would be, sort of ironic at best. And I'm sure the family then was particularly happy to have those remains.
Definitely.
Repatriated. Where did they end up?
So in his family plot in Medicine Hat, Canada. Yep.
That must have been very encouraging for the team, for your project team.
I think that's what truly lit the fire underneath us.
Uh-huh. But then where did you go from there? Because it's one thing to have this kind of one-off case, but then to decide and have the backing to continue, where did that come from?
So I guess it – prior to this, I had no knowledge of MIAs or the number of MIAs.
And what's your then academic background?
So actually, I'm a finance and business administration.
Oh, but of course. It ties right in.
Yeah. And but coming from a very large military family, when the civilian researcher was giving me information about the current losses that we have, I was shocked that we still had
the MIAs.
Yes, 82,000 plus MIAs from World War II on, and knowing what, so managing a lot, watching and managing operations in a cutting edge center, I can see the tools that can enhance this. And I think that's where, when we started, the team of us started meeting and discussing this, we truly saw a probability of possibly changing the environment.
By environment, you mean the way people think about recovering MIAs?
Correct.
And you came into this at what point, Samantha?
I came in after transferring to the university and taking the History 600 as part of a pilot program by the Defense POW MIA Counting Agency. They had to see if upper-level history students could do this kind of work. It was a class of about 13 of us. We met in the Humanities Building, not too far away from where this interview is taking place. And I met the team then after I finished the course and was on our second case that we dug archaeologically, and have been here since our last couple of years.
Well, now, how did the second one come about then? Because this one, you were actually contacted, and it was already underway. Yep. By several entities. How did you decide on this second case that you pursued?
So the second case that we worked on was First Lieutenant Frank Vazquez, who was a pilot from New Jersey. He was flying a P-47, was shot down over France near a small town called Bousquet, France. And what we did is at that time in 2015, and I apologize, I'm going to use acronyms, but DPMO, JPAC were the agencies prior to DPAA, which is the current era. And Congress reorged this entity in 2015 because of the number of recoveries that were being performed. And at that time, a team of us flew to Washington, D.C. and met with DPAA and informed them of the possibilities of working with academia and helping enhance this process. And we had a really good meeting. And then in December 2015, we learned about the Fizikas case, and we told DPAA that we're going to proceed with this case, and we wish that they would partner with us. And they acknowledged. So we scraped together all the discretionary funds we had in the Biotechnology Center that year to fund this mission. And it was, and DPAA partnered with us. They provided the tools, and it was a success. And this University of Wisconsin was the first academic partnership to work with.
I was going to ask, that seems remarkable that, and it's been a total of, 7 years or so now, and are there other academic departments that have gotten involved around the country based on your example?
Yep. So in 2016, we were the first academic partner. The following year, there were roughly six. The year after that, roughly 13.
Six other universities
or nonprofit entities. The year after that, 13. And then last year, they had 28 total. So you can see how we spearheaded this growth. What I've heard for this year, it's I think around 50 plus.
All out there partnering, looking for MIAs.
Yep.
And there's certainly plenty enough to go around.
Yes, there is.
At 82,000 just from World War II alone. We're going to look further at some of these found missing in action soldiers from World War II when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Charles Kinsitsky and Samantha Zinnen, and they are participants in a project called MIA Recovery and Identification that's associated with the University of Wisconsin and actually is the first academic partnership of its kind in the country to partner in the locating of MIAs between an academic institution and say the Department of Defense, and many have followed in the several years since the UW-Madison cooperation started. And we're looking at some of the case studies now, these MIAs that you have recovered, all of these at this point from World War II, and there are certain reasons for that, one being that you're looking at France and Belgium, primarily places where there were eyewitnesses as to where planes in particular went down. And not only that, but people kept track and remembered where these planes were said to have gone down. And we're getting now into some of these specific cases of individuals that you found and identified. And you mentioned one just before the break.
Yep. First Lieutenant Frank Fizikas. So First Lieutenant Frank Fizikas, as I stated, was a P-47 pilot flying back from a mission and was shot down over northern France near a small town called Bousquet, France. One of the things that we did immediately, we started the recovery in the summer of 2016. However, prior to that, we sent a scouting team to the site that we believed in 2015, in the summer of 2015. And our scouts met up with the landowner as well as the mayor and a number of other individuals. But the landowner was an eyewitness of that crash site. At that time, his name was Marc Couche. At that time, he was 8 years old. He was playing in his backyard when he heard the AA guns firing off, and he looked up. He saw the plane, and he saw the plane hit, and it landed in his plot of land. It's a small plot of land, and he, even to this day, I mean, he can tell the story as detailed as possible.
It would make an impression.
Yes, it
on
does.
On anyone, but an 8 year old, so much the more.
Yep. He was 84, roughly 84 years when we were on site, and he kept saying there was this road, and he kept saying it was north of the road. It's north of the road. It's somewhere in this area. So we thought this was an easy, find per se. I sent a team there to do a ground penetrating radar, and sure enough, it came up negative. There was nothing there. So this is in April. We're leaving in July, and so now we're in this kind of emergency situation. And we obtained a photo of the actual crash site roughly 2 or 3 days after the crash site from from British reconnaissance investigating the area. We believe they're looking for possible V rocket sites.
How did you ever find that?
There's a group in Scotland. It's called NCAP is the acronym, but it's the National Collection of Aerial Photography. They actually had the sites. They had three images in that area, and it was of our site and our crash. And the crash was in the northwest corner of these images. So then what we did is we took – that was just – I mean, in itself, that it was a roller coaster. We were worried that we were going to call it off or we were going to proceed. With that image, we then took Google Maps, an image of Google Maps, and overlaid it on that image. And we noticed that the road had moved north because a train line came in and shifted the whole.
Well, yeah, and in the course of 70, 75 years, even in France, where you think of things as being relatively stable, that much time passes, things yep. move.
So he was roughly about 100 feet off. However, we found the site, Mr. Couche. So north of the road, he obtained that land. It's a small plot. It's not even a quarter of an acre. But he kept that the ownership of that land his whole entire life to have this individual recovered. He waited for the U.S. military to come back and perform the recovery. And we were the ones to do it in 2016. You can see how this impacted them as a community because they knew this individual was fighting for them, trying to liberate them. The recovery of First Lieutenant Frank Fizikas took 2 years. We did invite the son, Frank Fizikas, who was roughly 6 months old when his father passed, to the site. And he was with us for roughly about a week. He helped us with that site. And it gives me goosebumps even to this day. Imagining yourself coming to your father's site that you've never known, never knew, and being at his gravesite. It was emotional for everyone. But honorable, knowing that we're a part of that, that is what makes this so special. And we worked that site. It was the middle of a cornfield, Actually, the first year was a cornfield. The second year was a hayfield. We worked that site 6 days a week, 10 to 12 hours a day, sun, rain. We were up to water, up to our ankles, because it's Flanders clay.
Oh, yeah, working, notorious.
And working with that when it's wet is like peanut butter. However, Mr. Koosh and Mrs. Koosh allowed us to come to their patio, which was covered every day to eat our lunch. And they were very kind people. Everybody within that area is extremely helpful, kind, because they know exactly what we're doing. And they truly appreciate what our soldiers did. But every day they would bring out chocolate to us. And it was very kind. And we thought, this must be a French...
It's a medium of hospitality I've observed in France and Belgium and Luxembourg. Yeah, the chocolate comes out pretty quickly when you're getting acquainted.
Yep. And after, 2 weeks, we're like, we appreciate it, but we don't want you to be spending money on us. And they said, oh, no, we need to, because this is what the soldiers gave us on our first day. That impacted me. So you can see and when they're telling us that, they tear up, and
sure,
you can still see how that period of time really affected them.
Did you take everything out of the site?
We did.
They must have had, I wonder at least if they didn't have mixed feelings about that, because for 70, 75 years, no, that had been a special kind of a sacred place, and now it's a place.
Well, sacred, yes. And I'll explain to you what the process was after that. So the site, when we finished it, was roughly 25 meters by 25 meters, about 6 meters deep. It was a massive pit. And the farmers were happy because we filled it back up, we took everything out, and they can start farming again. However, since now they know who that individual was, First Lieutenant Frank Fazekas, every town in France has a memorial for their loss, World War I and World War II. They put a plaque for Frank Fazekas on their loss in the center of their town. They also named one of their buildings after First Lieutenant Frank Fazekas and created a park in his name.
Because before that, of course, they didn't have a name.
They didn't know who he was. He was an unknown soldier.
Well, that must have been a moving experience for all involved.
Very.
And then he was his remains were repatriated?
Yes. And he's buried in Arlington this day.
Okay. We have time for one more case study of these MIAs that you two have, with your team, have tracked down and identified.
Okay.
Our next case was Second Lieutenant Walter Buster Stone. His family calls him Buster. He was from Alabama, as we now know. He was a P-47 pilot that crashed in France in the middle of a French forest. It was a national French forest that was surrounded by some small towns. And throughout the dig, we excavated the site. It had a pronounced crater, so we knew kind of where the center of the crater was, and spent most of the dig heavily working to dig out the case. We were trying to figure out how this crashed air, where were things, where were the batteries.
And where did the tip come from?
Eyewitness, again.
It was.
Yep, eyewitness walked the investigators to the site, and DOD told us exactly where the location was. So that was fairly easy. But now confirming that site is our site, as I stated earlier, we found M2 machine guns that identified it. We probably, a week in we were on that site, and that's when we found the machine guns. So that was a successful step.
So when you have some of these cases, just because you have a plane, and you can even know that it's the same type of plane, a P-47, a P-47D, mm-hmm. but the war had so many planes over so many areas. There are some areas where 60 of that type of plane in a 30-mile radius went down.
Yeah, P-47, pretty common.
Or any plane, when you're researching any case, it could be 60 in that little area. And when you're talking about locals, just because it's one case, and that's part of the reason you don't want to raise families' expectations, mm-hmm. because you could think you're going after one case when it's actually a different one.
Mm-hmm.
So connecting that, knowing the serial numbers to tie back to the investigation, that you're in the right spot and you have the right plane is incredibly important.
So once you find the machine guns and the serial numbers match, though, you still need to get some more definitive proof
as to
who was on the plane.
Yep. And as Sam stated, this was a national forest. So luckily, the crater was not filled back in as it would be in a farm field or in a neighborhood. So the crater was still a crater. And so it was less of a moving a significant amount of dirt to more getting right down to the details of it. And there were some items that we found, some personal items, that confirmed who we were seeking was there. And that's which we did find ossuous remains for that case as well.
Now, you know, there's I guess, two kinds of MIAs. One would be you have no idea where the body is, and another is you have a body but you don't know who it is. And you showed me a picture a minute ago, Chuck, of a cemetery, a large cemetery. Yes. Was it the Ardennes?
The Ardennes, yep.
And hundreds of graves in there.
Yes.
And the ones that are of MIAs or unidentified individuals have a red stone.
Yeah.
And it looked like of the cross-shaped configuration of the stones, roughly one leg of the four was red.
Yes.
Nobody knows who those men were.
Thousands of them. And that's one of the things that with academia, we're using tools with machine learning and AI or artificial intelligence, where we're trying to take in the information with X-Files and linking it with machine learning to information of the IDPFs or individual deceased personnel files and hoping to see if there's some possible high probability linkers that may say this person is this person. I'm giving away of all of our tools, which is – but it is, I think, one of the forward-thinking movements that we're on right now where then we can go in and hopefully if we do have positive linking – we could do some extremely fast exhumations and hopefully put names to those graves.
So when we were in the Ardennes this past summer, we had the chance to go to the Ardennes American Cemetery, and that was one of the most moving moments for the team. And the Tablets of the Missing, which list all the names, there are hundreds to a couple thousand missing names in each American cemetery. There's a rosette placed to each name where the person is later identified. In this cemetery, there are 12 rosettes. Our team and our project is responsible for two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And having that moment as a team, everyone was emotional. Like
extremely emotional.
I'm welling up now kind of thinking about it. But for all the hours, all the work we do, and it's a labor of love and a labor of duty, and it's not about any of us. It's about our soldiers.
Labor of gratitude.
Mm-hmm. We have just being able to see that and know that that's kind of the impact that the university can have is the Wisconsin Idea in Action.
Mm-hmm. And the prospects are promising that this kind of partnership with the Department of Defense will continue with UW-Madison?
Definitely.
Prospects are good. You have good support in the legislature and that those places where it's important?
They're working on it.
Well, thank you for just touching bases, I want to say, literally scratching the surface of this project, the UW-Madison Missing in Action Recovery and Identification Project. And the team lead for it has been one of my guests, and that's Charles Kinsitsky, and also the team historian, which was Samantha Zinnen. Thanks both for sharing your work with us.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.